Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I will be speaking with David LaRocca, the editor of The Philosophy of War Films. The book was published in 2018 by the University Press of Kentucky. The book, part of the Philosophy of Popular Culture series, presents essays by prominent scholars that try to answer questions related to films featuring war. David and I talk about many of the essays, as well as how he drew together his authors and his own contributions to the book. Welcome, David LaRocca. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Joel.
I am glad to talk to you about your edited collection called The Philosophy of War Films. It is a topic that is of interest to me in many ways, partly because, obviously, war films, as someone who is interested in film and in history, war films are a particularly important part of that particular combination. So I'm looking forward to this discussion and for a variety of reasons.
Me too.
So let's start a little bit with your background. As I say, even though you didn't quote unquote write the whole book, you edited the collection, your fingers are, and your mind is throughout the entire book. So we want to get a little sense of you. As much of your educational or other background that you'd like to share, and then talk a little bit about other things that you've written, because you've written quite a bit already, and we'll get into it that way.
Okay, great. Yeah, so again, thanks for this chance to talk with you and your listeners. So as far as my training goes in the academy, I studied philosophy and religion, as well as film theory and film history. And these worlds have come together in the form of books that I've been editing now three books in total, the war film books being the second of the three. The first was on Charlie Kaufman, who listeners may know as the creator of Adaptation and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, being John Malkovich. And more recently, a book entitled The Philosophy of Documentary Film, that has the range of documentary works at issue. I also have worked in American studies and philosophy, and some of my teaching appointments have been at Ithaca College in the School of Communications, and at Cortland in philosophy, and most recently at Binghamton University in the cinema department.
That's funny. I'm looking at one of the blurbs that you had for the series, and it's by Guy Westwell. I have actually interviewed him for a previous podcast, so you're in good company as far as the people I've talked to. I'll have to take a look at The Philosophy of Documentary Film, because that is one of my interests, is documentary film. So maybe we can talk about that book at some point as well. So
I'd like that very much. Great.
But anyway, sounds good. Now, obviously, as we've already talked about, this is an edited collection. And what led you to decide, this is part of a series that the University of Kentucky does called the Philosophy of Popular Culture series. So obviously, all three of the books that you mentioned start with the philosophy of. and obviously they must have others in the series. What led you to decide that this was a particular road you wanted to come down with this, and in particular with this book?
Good. Well, let me say one thing about the series, just to orient listeners to this. So it's the series is called The Philosophy of Popular Culture, and it includes many, more than a dozen titles. And it was at the University Press of Kentucky for a long time, and now it's recently moved to Lexington Books at Roman and Littlefield. So, for example, my latest documentary film is with them. As a result, you get a kind of uniformity of title. So all of the titles in the Kentucky series say The Philosophy of, and typically the titles have been about directors, or, for example, Michael Mann, Tim Burton, the Coen brothers, Spike Lee, or they're about genres, the philosophy of war films being one of the genre. The lone exception is the Charlie Kaufman book, since although he is a director, he's mainly known as a screenwriter. So that was an unusual and useful addition to the series. As for the approaching the topic and the genre, from my particular vantage, why I was eager to work on this, I have a background both practically and theoretically in photography. And over the years, I have been especially attuned to war photography and photojournalism and the documentation of war through still photographs. And so everyone from Matthew Brady and his studio in the Civil War through Robert Capa in World War II and Vietnam's Philip Jones Griffiths to James Noctfay and Susan Mizellis and others, studying them partly prompted the question, what is the mediation between me as a viewer and the lived experience of the war like? What's happening between me and, as you were alluding to, history, the ongoing process of what's happening in the world? And this became quite pointed when I began thinking about a photograph by Jeff Wall. It's called Dead Troops Talk. And this is a hyper-realistic photograph depicting soldiers who are bleeding and injured. Some are dead, and yet they seem quite spirited. They're laughing, they're pointing, they have mocking facial gestures. And it takes a little while, but not too long, to realize that this is a fabrication, that this is, in fact, a staged photograph. And this got me to thinking about whether fiction, or the fabrication of some scene of war, might in fact prompt more thoughtful and even perhaps more genuine notes on the realities of war. So in this particular case, the juxtaposition of comedy and tragedy, that sense that there's a kind of astonishing absurdity to the way people, an astonishing absurdity to the way people are injured and die, that there's so much contingency and so much accident in war, and that it's very hard to derive meaning from war. Hence the pursuit of things like the victory of battle or the victory of the war to give meaning to the deaths. So that sort of exploration was complemented by a related investigation of this happening in documentary film. So a couple of examples will suffice. Christian Frey's War Photographer from 2001, which is a portrait of the photographer James Noctfay. If you put that beside Werner Herzog's works like Fata Morgana or Lessons of Darkness, or his Little Dieter Needs to Fly and Rescue Dawn, what you find is a dialogue about the nature of fabrication and fakery or reenactment. And I wanted to pursue that further into the study of war films in particular, although all of this is informed by image-making photography through film.
Okay. Sorry. don't worry, I'll edit around this. So obviously then you've got a development, you've pulled together a number of authors
to discuss the issues related. So I'm assuming that your point was to try to, as you mentioned it, this is less, war documentaries and more war and narrative film.
Well, it's both. It's at least that's the ambition. So in some ways, the title of the book, which, as I was saying, is part of a series, and so I didn't quite make it, but it's a pretty grandiose thing to say, right? The philosophy of war films. So I try to take up the as much of that expanse as possible to include feature fictions, which is to say the movies that we typically associate with war films, as well as documentaries, but also look at things like newsreels and even engage with the history of war photography, because that is sort of at the origin and also parallels a lot of war documentary work. So if you take just one quick example, say Ken Burns's recent Vietnam documentary multi-part series, mm-hmm. consider the extent to which that documentary film relies on still imagery.
Right.
And Burns is famous enough to have almost invented a certain approach to filming still photographs, the pan and the zoom in, the gentle zoom in or the gentle withdrawal from the image, so that it's a quite distinctive style. But my point is only to say that when we're used to talking about war films in a documentary context, they may rely quite heavily on still imagery.
Right. It's interesting with Ken Burns. I mean, obviously he had done documentaries, historical documentaries before the Civil War one, but that one is obviously the one that brought him into the limelight to the average person. And that was one of the things that the reviewers, popular reviewers, would talk about is his use, because obviously the Civil War documentary is consistently all about, it only has photos, except for a little bit of footage at the beginning and the end. So it is built just on photos and some of the newer ones. In fact, it's almost funny when you watch one of his and suddenly there's talking people, you know, it's documentary footage, you know, it's newsreels or whatever, news footage. And it's just strange. It seems like his depends almost on using images only, as opposed to also including sound and video.
That's right. And we wanted to give credence to that as a real part of what we mean when we say war films.
Right. So how many, I counted and then forgot. How many people did you pull together for this? For the listener, this is not a slim volume. This thing's 538 pages long. So this gets really in depth, which is great, because I think it's a topic that definitely deserves this kind of attention. So I just wanted to mention that up front, that this is it's a hefty volume, so to speak. So that, which is good. So you've got, how many essays were there total?
So there's 14 contributors plus myself, right, would bring it to 15 chapters across four parts. And I also have what appears to be a lengthy introduction. It comes out to 77 pages,
right,
with footnotes. And that's meant to give some orientation to the subject. And I might also point out, as far as editorial intervention, I have an appendix that I call the Multifarious Forms of War Films. And it's an attempt at a taxonomy of subgenres. Because one of the things that was most surprising in doing the research for the book and also with working with the contributors is the way in which war films as a single type, if someone says, if you're trying to define it, what is a war film as a type, you find there's a lot of slippage between other subgenres. So for example, just taking a couple off of the first page of the appendix, I have a subgenre called childhood and coming of age during wartime. And all of these films would, you might say, be considered bona fide war films, but their dominant dramatic arc tends to be about children. And that's what they all have in common. Or to take another example, war romance and melodrama. This would be where you take the usual recipes and genre classifications and patterns that you see in say romance and you import them into a wartime context. Sometimes it's home front and other times it's on the front, depending on which film you're in. Mm-hmm. But this is meant to show how rich war films as a genre is and how many and how prevalent this is in our media culture and film culture.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you can see that. I mean, in, as you mentioned, as a, you know, for culture, you know, war films, have you ever looked at, are there periods in film history where war films become more important, less important, or more made, I guess is the best way of putting it, or there, it seems to me there are periods of time, and I'm thinking, and I could be wrong, I'm just going by memory, that around the Vietnam War period, there were not a huge amount of war films being made during the period, and it took a while afterwards before they started up again.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I did notice that in trying to research the book, but also the taxonomy, is you might say there are more popular films to depict than others. One war that seemed to struggle to not only have representative examples, but also examples that would become indelible and influence other films, and that's the Korean War. So although I have a couple of dozen films listed, there really aren't a lot of names there, a lot of titles that would strike one as indelible in the same way that, say, many dozens of World War II films or Vietnam War films would qualify. I think a second answer to the same question, though, would be how surprisingly durable the war film genre is. And if it does ebb and flow based on cultural and economic and political factors, it is surprising how robust it is as a genre. And partly because of its capacity to become hybridized. So you'll see some trends where a war story wants to be told, but it needs to hide a bit. So it might go into a realm of science fiction and allegory. Mm-hmm. Other times, to be more politically or ethically charged, it might become quite graphic and so-called realist in its depiction of war. So I think that part of the answer to this question is we sort of want to be interested in why war films have been around so long and why they continue to proliferate.
I think one sort of thinking about this whole concept of periods of war films, I've noticed that the current wars, I guess I'm going to put it that way, there doesn't seem to be a fear to make movies about it as it's going on. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, like I say, people, you know, the only Vietnam War film I can think of that was actually made at the time of the Vietnam War, and it just went out of my mind there for a minute. But we seem to see plenty of war films now that, you know, they don't seem to have any problems making about a war that's currently still going on or was going on in more strength at the time. So many films, and in fact, there's a couple in the book that you talk about, or that your contributors talk about, as far as Iraq war films and things like that.
Yes, that's true. Maybe it's because our wars are lasting so long that we have to take stock at some point. But it's a very good observation. I mean, even as a little clue to your point about Vietnam, in the taxonomy, you see that the only film I have listed as made during the Vietnam War, technically in terms of time period, is The Green Berets. Right,
that's what it was. I was going to say, yeah. And I said, I don't want to make a mistake there.
Yeah. So, you know, and you also think about that's a John Wayne film.
Right.
And he is, in many, and your listeners will be familiar, I mean, he's a carryover in a way from both established heroic war films of World War II, but also he's being translated in from Westerns. And there's a way in which this is a kind of quintessential contemporaneous way of approaching a politically charged war. Whereas if you look further in the list to films that are made after the war ends, I have listed here Taxi Driver, Martin Scorsese's 1976, but also Coming Home, The Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now, and then into the 80s with The First Blood, Rambo series, Platoon, Full Metal Jacket, and so on. The stock taking takes on a very different shape in the post-war period, post-Vietnam period.
Yeah, I'm older probably than you, and I do remember when Coming Home came out, and the reviewers, one of the things Coming Home, there was a lot of discussion about it being one of the first films to talk about, you know, to actually, you know, look at the Vietnam War, and it became not that unusual. In fact, now it's become almost the norm that we see movies that deal with aftermath. And what happened to the people, where during this certain period of time, there's, you know, certain war films that, you know, they weren't meant to do that, and they weren't played that way. But so I can see, I do remember a lot of discussion about that at the time Coming Home came out. And as far as the Green Berets, I'm pretty sure that was John Wayne's own pet project during the war, when things weren't, when support wasn't very high. And I think my memory serves as far as the Green Beret. And if you've ever seen it, it's basically almost a World War II film and a Western almost, but, you know, as far as, but being done in Vietnam. So it's a strange film.
Yeah. And your point about the, what we might call the Coming Home or the home front film gets quite a bit of attention in this book, partly because it is something that's gotten more attention since that very indelible film, Coming Home. I did a series of films, a kind of film clinic at the Brooklyn Historical Society a couple of years back, where we watched films in this subgenre, a film called Return, Werner Herzog's Little Dieter Needs to Fly, Orin Moverman's The Messenger. And another one I might mention that we didn't screen but is relevant is Taking Chance. So in these films, you know, if you take just especially the Messenger and Taking Chance, you never see any combat. Mm-hmm. So these are like you say, that dealing with the aftermath, and this is this might be considered an innovation in our ability to deal with the emotional landscape of war, that it's not just something that happens on the battlefield and then is contained, but in fact comes home.
Right. And it has become a more normal subgenre, where it's not unusual to see war-related films that deal with aftermath or deal with the home front, it as opposed to just being battle movies, so to speak.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit more about the process that you went through to pull the material together. And as you say, you do have a very long and interesting introduction. And then, of course, you end up doing the last essay, although it's part of the part. So you do get to sort of start and end the whole thing. But what did you do? And I mentioned this to you before we started recording, that I always like interviewing editors of collections, because I think it's an interesting process that, you know, it doesn't really occur in popular nonfiction or works where you get this kind of concept regularly. But I still think it's an interesting way to learn about a topic, because you get so many different points of view. How did you pull together this large group of people to develop essays on this topic?
Well, I might just emphasize your point about pulling together these different points of view. That's one of my great pleasures in having the opportunity to edit volumes like this, is to shift away from trying to offer the reader, let's say, 500 pages of my own opinion on various films, but instead reach out to people who've thought long and hard about a great number of war films and other subjects, and invite them to present their opinions and their latest thoughts. In this way, I think of editing volumes like trying to assemble a wonderful dinner party. The idea is that you think about who will sit next to whom at the table and what they might talk about and what kinds of questions you might prompt to get the conversation going. So I think that this is one of the great virtues of edited collections, that you have all of these points of view. Now, as far as the nuts and bolts of trying to gather these folks, I'll say that I was inspired by writing by many of them as I was doing my own research. So almost everyone in the book has written articles or full books about war films. And I was simply writing as a fan in many cases to say that I had gotten something significant from their writing, and would they consider writing something new for this new collection. So I was gratified. You can imagine that I had such a wonderful response from so many able critics and theorists. And as the material came together and conversations developed, the content of the book took shape. So the way that it's divided into four parts, we can walk through that. But essentially, these are going to be parts that are familiar to the categories of philosophy. Say part one about aesthetics. So this is about, and I'll just go into detail on just this one part. Mm-hmm. This is about the way in which a viewer is related to the content on screen, and not just as you might say, the content of what is it about. So is it about World War II or Vietnam, but also how is the viewer related to film as a medium or cinema as a sonic landscape, that is a space where sounds are happening. How does this change, if at all, when we move from film to digital, or when we move from films that are made on sets to films that are made in the field, or for that matter, films that are made in a kind of computer-generated space? So those are aesthetic questions, and then they trickle and shift into the questions that happen in parts 2, 3, and 4. So talk more about that.
Right. In fact, we were just talking about this, and in fact, one of the ones that you're talking about of how things come out and how visuals and that part of it. The one that struck me of the first part especially was the lenses into war, digital verite, and Iraq war films. Mm-hmm. I only mentioned in that one because it was one that I it was one of the first, because I didn't read the book straight through it at first. Mm-hmm. I sort of went to the particular essays that seemed interesting to me at first, and so I think it was a great example, that particular one by Stacy Peebles. Mm-hmm. That talked about this current thing as far as films is concerned, in this case, the Iraq War. But right. She what I liked about it so much is that she brings examples of other films so that it makes it easier to films that aren't necessarily even in the war genre to show how, when she makes her points, that to make it easier to understand what she's trying to say as far as this whole idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hers is a wonderful example of a work by someone who's deeply familiar with literature. She's also a wonderful Cormac McCarthy scholar as well. Mm-hmm. Her familiarity with other modes or other mediums, literature and film, as well as her attunement to the ways in which Iraq war films in particular have introduced filmmaking into the narrative. So you have now soldiers who are depicted in Iraq war films making films of themselves, mm-hmm. Bringing portable cameras with them, and also a kind of auxiliary space, we might call it Skype video or FaceTime video, the way in which soldiers are communicating back to the home front through live video feeds. This also breaks down that divide between war front and home front, and in effect brings the soldier home and brings the domestic space into the very immediate war front.
And it's this first part, like you say, the aesthetics, you actually have two essays that deal with the concepts of surveillance. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, that first part does a good job. And like I say, in most of these first essays, they're about various films. There's only one of the first part one essays that's about a particular film, in this case, Charlie Chaplin's Shoulder Arms. But the nice thing is that the way things are brought together is that there's a very good representation, of, to use a word, of how these films fit into the entire, you know, into films as a whole, not just the war aspect of it, but also their place in the film industry, or not industry so much as film collection.
Yeah, and absolutely. And another way to approach it too is to see that in part one, especially, you have the interaction between technology and culture and story. Mm-hmm. So these are three among other elements that come to play. But as technologies change, the very ways in which we tell stories begins to change. So surveillance is not just a thing that's happening to soldiers, but it also becomes a thing that they do to one another. They are surveilling themselves. They're filming themselves. And this takes on dramatic effect in feature films as well as in documentaries. You'll find this a recurring pattern, and it's a function of technology.
Yeah, because one of the things they said about the, you know, one of the major points that's always been made about the Vietnam War is that it was the first televised war, because it was the first war that the United States was involved in that happened after television became popular, even though Korea television was around at that point, making, you know, trying to film and get that material available to be used on television was very difficult. Whereby Vietnam, you know, reporters were regularly in there with cameras and things. And now, as you point out, you know, ever since the first Gulf War, where suddenly video has just become a normal part of warfare and being people being able to see this material. And I think it does add to the overall philosophy of, you know, war. And it can, if you can see it, does that change your view of war?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what do you mean by see it and hear it?
Right.
Do you mean unmediated, or if that's such a thing were possible? In other words, all the things we're talking about in this book are mediations, whether they're live or they're very, very high resolution or very grainy, is a matter for debate. But essentially, all of these are forms of mediation.
And in fact, let's skip ahead real quickly, because this one comes right into this. In part three, The Ethical Tribulations of War, one of the essays, The Work of Art in the Age of Embedded Journalism, Fiction versus Depiction in Zero Dark 30 by K.L. Evans. That, I think, is pretty much what we're talking about. The idea that, you know, well, not in this case, it's still journalists, but that what does that mean, and how does your view of material, or how should it be affected by how it was created? I mean, the fact that a journalist is embedded, and this has even been a, you know, controversial topic within the journalism profession of embedded journalism. And I think that particular essay, because, and it tells right from the title, Fiction versus Depiction, you know, and in this case, Zero Dark 30, which is not the only essay in this book about Zero Dark 30, which I find interesting as far as what it says about that film.
Yeah, it's a very controversial film. And for that reason, we felt like it should have a little more space, also to keep the book contemporary. And to, you know, although we begin with early films, like you mentioned, Charlie Chaplin's Shoulder Arms from 1918, and here we are in 2018, we are also contending with these contemporary innovations, or you might say corruptions, of journalism. And K.L. Evans's chapter is astonishing for highlighting precisely these very difficult questions that we ask when it comes to the relationship between truth and fabrication, or fact and fiction. Many people in the military, from what I've read and heard, have been, they're quite distraught about the way in which Zero Dark 30 portrays the intelligence world. one among many examples of a problem would be the ways in which Maya, played by Jessica Chastain, appears to essentially solve the problem by herself, even though she's living within a world of intelligence officers and is benefiting from their input and insight. This would in a way show Zero Dark Thirty to be more of a mythological story about how one wants to be a heroic discerner of truths, you know, one person alone among a mass of humanity. But in fact, this is not how intelligence gathering works, and the film appears to fail its audience, including military people as well as the general audience on this. And it's also a question about the relationship between journalism and storytelling. So Mark Boal is the screenwriter, and he's also the author of The Hurt Locker, which is also very strongly contested among military historians and theorists of film as being problematical for its depictions. So, yeah.
Plus, and the other issue, and it's one more layer, is Zero Dark Thirty and its, its development with help from, how much help did they get as far as the film was concerned by people within the government or within the military that might have had their own ideas they wanted to make sure were included.
Yeah. There's at least one book that I know of, and there's probably more, that talk about Hollywood's relationship with the military,
right,
and how this has been a long-standing collaboration, everything from the U.S. military loaning aircraft carriers for the filming of Top Gun, and on down the line in terms of access and ability to use facilities to depict on the ground forces or facilities. So it becomes a question of whether one can speak truth or show truth if it's unflattering or if it is more complicated than one wants it to be. The fact is that as a narrative, Zero Dark Thirty is compelling and it is entertaining, but whether this is going to accord with history or fact, or truth for that matter, is highly problematical.
Yeah, I think the whole issue of and we're going to say at Hollywood because it isn't obviously a Hollywood film, the need for a hero in a Hollywood film, when you put that against, reality or nonfiction, I use nonfiction as opposed to reality because what's reality, tends to run into that because of the need for a hero isn't going to always be work with a story that might have involved or definitely involved multiple people. And there have been many examples of that where I've seen discussion, and not necessarily military, but other films where the whole idea is that they're supposedly based on a true story, but the person comes out being superhuman. And, that's not always – that's not regularly the case of what happens.
Yeah. And to contrast that with, say, the approach that Terrence Malick takes in The Thin Red Line, which also has two essays dedicated to it in part four, this is an entirely different approach that uses historical events, in this case the Battle of Guadalcanal, as a context in which to explore, you might say, the poetic or the existential or the metaphysical quality of war. So part of Malick's style is often a contrast, or you might say a coupling of the human with the natural, almost to say, doesn't it seem like the human is not quite part of nature, and that the thing in this particular case, in The Thin Red Line, the thing that humans do is they make war. And yet, if you look to nature, you can also see war, you can see contest and struggle. And this is partly why these chapters are ordered this way, is that if you are reading consecutively, you're thinking about the debate between fiction and depiction, and then you come to someone like Malick, who takes this approach that is let's call it poetic.
I didn't want to also, I wanted to, there, another essay I wanted to make sure I mentioned, because I think it, you know, because so far we've talked about films that tend to be reasonably well-known, popular, not pop, you know, that the average person might have seen on a regular, you know, might see on a regular basis. But there's one chapter in part three that I found particularly interesting because it goes outside the bubble of most of many of the films that are in, and that's the ubiquitous absence of the enemy in contemporary Israeli war films. That's a completely, I mean, that's sort of, in one way, it certainly is important with the overall topic, but one of the things I liked about it was that it sort of went out of, outside the box a little bit of many of the other essays, which, and it gave us a little bit of a view of how another country might be dealing with a particular, you know, with war. And I'll let you pronounce the author's name because I don't want to mess it up.
Holger Petsch. Is the author. And yes, I think with Holger's piece and also with Inger Brody's piece on Westerns and samurai films, both of those chapters are really organized and inspired by the idea to do just what you said, which is to take us out of an American Western, predominantly Western context of war, and to think through, are there important differences or, frankly, similarities between the ways that that war films are constituted in other cultures? And Holger Petsch's reading, he's gathering three films, Beaufort, Waltz with Bashir, and Lebanon, for critical analysis. And, you know, what he finds is that there is a continual erasure or withholding of the presence of the enemy. So the idea that we're not allowed to identify with the enemy, to see the war from the enemy's point of view, and instead we are meant to identify most strongly, since that's our only choice, with the Israeli military. So it's a very potentially controversial thesis, because it seems to suggest a certain consistency of approach from one filmmaker to another, from one generation to another, that would suggest a certain, you might say, Israeli approach to making war films.
But I also think, one of the things it says, it just happens to be Israeli in this case, is that war films have a political bent to them. It's almost a given, because wars are, in the end, well, I don't know if you want to call them political actions, but they certainly are generally, most of the time when we talk wars, these are things that are done by, you know, countries and people in charge, so to speak. And so it is interesting to see the view of another country and how they look at war films.
Yeah, and that's a very important philosophical point, especially as it comes to the relationship of film, whether it's a documentary or a fiction, to the political and ethical climate of the time. So, for example, let's just radically change our context for a second and say you want to make a romantic comedy. If you're making this film, you're probably going to be commenting on or engaging with mores that have to do with marriage and sex and children and career, you know, the usual things that are featured in a romantic comedy, maybe in-laws, parents, and siblings, and so on. The point is that there, while there is grave ethical content there, that romantic comedies are almost always polished in such a way, especially Hollywood ones, polished in such a way that their political effect is muted. So if you want to find the political effect, you often need strong readers to go in and point those things out. So like, you know, someone like Slavoj Žižek is very good at looking at what seems like a pure entertainment and drawing out of it some sort of deep moral or political catastrophe. But to the reason I bring up this contrast is that if you say to yourself, okay, I want to make a film about the hunt for Osama bin Laden or a film about Vietnam, then you are instantly placing yourself in the midst of a huge political and ethical morass. You're saying, I'm going to have an opinion about a historical event of which I may be, if not partially, then quite, perhaps significantly ignorant of. Wars are notoriously classified events, and you may have to speculate on things that you'll have no hope of ever knowing about. So in an odd way, war films are right from the beginning a deeply fabricated event. They have to imagine and create worlds where there may be no evidence or compelling reason to substantiate.
I know it's gotten to a point now where it takes a little while. You don't get it like, but it's not unusual to see war film, a film that takes place during a war where after a while you have to just assume that most of the things that are happening in the film probably didn't really happen. If they happen, they certainly didn't happen the way they're being depicted, because there the story becomes more important and the war just happens to be the backdrop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this one I want to sort of step out a little bit from the book, although it's probable, that it gets dealt with in some ways. The idea of war films, the romanticizing of war because of films, is a topic it's one of the things I've struggled with in my thoughts of war, is that there tends to be a romanticism, especially after the war, yeah. The farther away you get from the war, that it becomes romanticized. Yeah. Have we seen examples of this in particular, and is it continuing, so to speak? Are we still seeing films where war becomes this, this whole idea of being, it builds your character, or your life is better because of it, and things like that, even though we obviously hear enough stories that tell us it's not necessarily true.
Yeah. Well, let me return again to reply to that to romantic comedies, because they have the word romance in them. And when we say romantic comedy, we probably don't know this, but we want the film to romanticize romance. In other words, to make it seem like something that ends in a marriage. Mm-hmm. That's the short formula for that. And as one example of this, Charlie Kaufman, the screenwriter and director, said that romantic comedies messed him up romantically, because in the world, his real world, his lived experience, it didn't align with what he saw in romantic comedies. So that's why, in large measure, why Kaufman writes about romance the way he does. It's troubled, it's vexing, it's painful, and so on. Now, the reason I bring that up is to substantiate your point about the romance of war, that just like with Zero Dark Thirty, there's this tendency to find a romantic figure, a heroic figure, often who is imputed with qualities like purity and goodness and access to truth, often solitude, so the single person against the mass, and so on. So there are these character traits, as you were alluding to, that we are drawn to. And whether or not these are justifiable based on the historical record is sort of secondary, because what we find is that war films do want to present this burnished picture, and present us with the option of deciding if someone is heroic or not. And then the question is relates to something that we talk about in the book quite a bit, is, what are war films for? Why are we making them? And one answer would be for precisely the reasons you're saying, because we get a lot of pleasure, although this is maybe perverse, right? I mean, you can understand getting pleasure from a comedy, but why would we get pleasure from watching graphic depictions of war? This, at the same time, seems to be the pleasure in having pathos activated in us, a kind of moral intensity that allows us to feel really strongly about people who are in grave circumstances.
And speaking of which, this is just, you know, like I say, we've talked about a number of the essays, but there's one other one that sort of relates to what we've just talked about. It's in part three, The Ethical Tribulations of War, and that's the one General Patton and Private Ryan, The Conflicting Reality of War in Films About War by Andrew Fiala. It literally is this topic of, you know, one of the issues with Patton when the film came out was the glorification of war. And it definitely was controversial at the time, as far as that part of it is concerned. And then in his essay, he then contrasts it and compares it with Saving Private Ryan, where it's a fictional story, but does it create a more real picture of what war is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that we're perhaps always thrown back on the question about our motivations for making war or for making war films or for watching them is, are all war films inherently anti-war? And this is part of the paradox that you think, well, we wouldn't make war films to promote war, in other words, say, here is a heroic context that an individual has, we've created this myth of this individual fighting. For that reason, we'd like to fight more wars. So is it the case that there's this inherent hope that each war film is in fact an anti-war film? It says, here's this horrible, tragic thing that we did or that we're saying we did, and we should not do that again. On the other hand, there may be people who think of some war films, whether it's Patton or American Sniper, more recently, as being just out and out advertisements for a certain kind of war mentality.
Yeah, I can think of one off the top of my head because it's not one that's discussed in the book, but in any detail. But Paths of Glory is the perfect example I can think of where, and it's one of those films that for a long time the average person it was almost impossible to see because it didn't come out in video right away, and yet now when you can view it, I mean it's clearly anti-war, and yet it was made in a period of time where you would have thought those kind of films would likely not get much interest.
Yes. Yes. Frederick Jameson mentions Kubrick's film and brings it into an interesting context of the writing of war, the literature of war, and how Kubrick is part of this tradition of imagining what the conditions for war are, because essentially war filmmaking is the invention of a world. Very much like literature,
and like I say, that it's funny that that is a definite. Like I said, that's the one example I can think of because for the longest time, as I say, I wanted to see it, and I finally got a chance, and I said, it was the film that it was advertised. I still watch it occasionally, and you just can't get over how well it depicts everything related in this particular case to a war, in this case, war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that would be a great example in some ways contrasted with Zero Dark Thirty. Mm-hmm. So Paths of Glory as allowing itself to be a thoroughgoing work of fiction without trying to break the bounds of that and celebrating it cinematically and through acting and dialogue. Whereas Zero Dark Thirty, on the other hand, resists the notion of artifice. So there's almost an aspiration to the documentary. Right. There's this notion that what you're seeing, quote unquote, really happened, and that's a very surprising demand that a feature fiction makes. In other words, without calling attention to itself, without it being a kind of meta comment on itself. Zero Dark Thirty seems to quite seriously take up the notion that it can present you with the way things on the ground really happened.
Mm-hmm. Even though I think for obvious reasons, Paths of Glory does such a great job of proving, of showing how something could happen. You know, mm-hmm. it's so well written and developed that, you know, how it happened seems almost fatalistic. You knew it, you know, it had to come to this. And as opposed to something else where you sometimes feel like it's just being, you know, it's somebody put the pieces together to make a jigsaw puzzle, but does it really represent the overall view of the original image?
Very much so. And I think, too, invoking Kubrick in this particular case, you're reminded of that. Those initial questions that I was saying came up for me with war photography, which is the ways in which fiction is revelatory of truth. And that is always a surprising thing. So I think that the way in which Paths of Glory affected you and continues to affect you speaks not to the power of history, but to the power of art.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I say, I suspect this is a topic that, and this book just does, I really enjoy these essays because I felt like they looked at so many different ways of reviewing the concepts of war films and as you say, the philosophy of that we could probably go on and on discussing not only these specific essays, but also similar topics. But before we sign off, I just wanted to ask, and you know, you've mentioned your three books, including the one that was done after this one on documentary, but are you have other things in development or other things you're working on as far as future writing?
Yes, I'm at present working on two volumes on the film work of Stanley Cavell, and these will hopefully be appearing in the coming year or so.
That sounds good. Well, as I say, this is one of those topics where I could find myself talking for a long, long time. But like I also mentioned, it's always a good idea to give enough information so that people see, okay, this is a book I definitely want to check out or learn more about, and leave it with that rather than going on and on for hours in which they say, okay, I've heard enough, so to speak.
Enough.
I really want to thank you for taking the time. And as I said before, this book is, it's just an unbelievable amount of interesting information and thought process that I think is worth, definitely worth reaching out and learning and reading, and hopefully people will do so. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you, Joel. It means so much. And I'm sure that the contributors would feel, as I do, deeply gratified that you you got so much from the book. And I hope your listeners will as well. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for making the time and for engaging me on such interesting material. Thanks. I'm really grateful.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Joel.
A great thanks to David. I think you will find the essays thought-provoking and educational. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.